December 16th is always a fascinating day, or the day of a fascinating phenomenon in the church, the beginning of the novena in preparation for Christmas. Obviously, we're not following that tradition here. That's why there's so few people here. But if you were at any parish in the country, practically, at 4 o'clock this morning, you would be overwhelmed with the number of people. Church is packed to overflowing. It's a phenomenon that is fascinating not only from the religious standpoint or devotional standpoint, spiritual, but also even from a cultural or social standpoint. It's something to be studied if you want to understand the longings of a people or what motivates a culture or some of the roots of a culture. You have to look at phenomena like this, because it seems to be uniquely Filipino that on December 16th at 4 o'clock in the morning, we've got millions of people going to Mass, including many, many people who never go to Mass the rest of the year. So there's something very striking about it. I've spoken to lots of people about the phenomenon. I'm always in awe of it, even though I myself can't participate anymore. I've spoken to people who, for whom the participation in the Simbangabi Novena is like, was when they were young, like their first personal connection with the life of the church. Simbangabi Novena and Holy Week. Like, that's what has impact on people's religious upbringing. Not everybody, but a lot of people. If it were not for that, they would not have any connection to the church in their psyche. It doesn't mean that they are active Catholics or go to Mass, but they recognize something vital in these phenomena. And it's rather complex, because the official description of the novena is Aguinaldo Masses, a novena in honor of the Blessed Virgin Mary for the preservation of the country in the faith. That's the official term. But no one calls it Aguinaldo Masses. I never hear anyone called it that. It's always Simbangabi, at least in Metro Manila. And I don't hear anybody talking about the Blessed Virgin Mary or about the preservation of the country and the faith. It's always about, it's basically a celebration of Christmas. So it's a very complex thing, because there's what's officially happening, and there's what's actually happening, and there's what's happening in the minds of the different people. For young people, this is National Youth Day, you know. National Youth Day. I am the youth here. So, okay, well, anyway. Well, there's a child over here. National Youth Day, because the youth come out in droves for this novena. It's a kind of rite of passage or something. It's like, this is the thing you do, and maybe you did it yourselves when you were a little bit younger. But for them, it's a celebration. It's also a kind of first step of independence. Like, I'm going and my parents aren't going. Who would think of such a thing? Before, it was the parents making their kids go to Mass. All of a sudden, in this novena, the parents are going to work, or maybe they tried to make the novena, but it's the young people who actually complete it. And it's a combination of penance and celebration. Penance, because who gets up at 3 in the morning, at 3:30 in the morning, to go to Mass? It's hard one day. It's very hard to do for 9 days. So there's a clear penitential aspect to it, but it's also very festive. I didn't hear any fireworks or any music this morning, but I know some parishes, I mean, it's like a fiesta, especially after the first Mass, after the 4 o'clock Mass, because there's people coming in for the next Mass, and so you have this combination of a huge crowd who has just celebrated, and they're looking for their puto bombong or something, and then the next big crowd is coming in for the 5:30 Mass, and it's just traffic and people chatting, and it's really amazing. Okay, and there's a special liturgy for the Simbangabi. From December 17 to 24, the whole church follows the special liturgies of that stage of Advent. But on 16, what we're doing here is the Mass of Saturday of the second week of Advent. But in the Simbangabi, there's different readings, different prayers. There's the Gloria, it's a whole, it's a completely different liturgy. Well, if some of you might have gone to that Mass already, so this is your second Mass already, and it's a completely different thing. For us, we are celebrating what has been referred to as the Elijah Mass, because the readings both refer to that great Old Testament prophet, Elijah. Okay, so let's shift gears, aware, fully aware, that this is a day of the beginning of the Novena, that it's National Youth Day, and that that's a rich occasion in the life of the Church in the Philippines. Fully aware of that, let's just focus for a moment on these readings. Elijah, of course, is one of the main figures of the Old Testament. He, in fact, represents the whole prophetic tradition. When Jesus was transfigured on the mountain, who appeared with him? Moses and Elijah. Moses representing the law, Elijah representing the prophets. So Elijah, not only was he a great prophet himself, but he represents that whole tradition of spokesmen for God, people who represent God and convey his will and his word to the people. Elijah also is significant because of his unusual, what do you call it, the end of his life. He was taken up to heaven in a chariot of fire, or whirlwind, whatever that means. He didn't die? Where is he? Where was he? And how did he get back on the mountain of the Transfiguration? What happened to him? It's all very mysterious. And then there was the very clear tradition in the Old Testament that he would come again. Elijah would come again, and he went up on a chariot of fire. He'll come again and prepare for the coming of the Messiah. And this was deep in the religious sensibility, or the, if I could use the word, imagination of the Jews, that Elijah has to come again, and he will come again. So there was great expectation that he would come again, Elijah. When John's father, Zechariah, first got the announcement that he would have a son, that his barren wife would have a son, he was told by the angel Gabriel, your son is going to come in the spirit and power of Elijah. So even before he was conceived, there was a deep, a profound connection between Elijah and John the Baptist, which is why we focus on Elijah today, because this is the middle of Advent, and John the Baptist is the key figure for preparing us. When John the Baptist appeared on the scene, a lot of people thought he was the Messiah. But if he was the Messiah, where was Elijah? Because Elijah has to come first. And if he's Elijah, well, where's the Messiah? And there's a lot of speculation about this. If you remember, in John's Gospel, there's an occasion where the authorities go to John himself and say, are you the Messiah? And he says, no. And then they ask him, are you Elijah? And he says, no. Are you the prophet? No. Well, who are you anyway? Who are you? I'm just a voice. I'm just a voice in the desert. So that's what John says about himself. But in this Gospel, the disciples, this is the three big ones, Peter, James, and John, they ask Jesus why the scribes say that Elijah must come first. Now, why did they ask that? Because they just saw Elijah on the mountain. They said, well, is he here? Did he come? Is he going to come? What's the story here? And Jesus gives them this very mysterious answer that Elijah will come, and that Elijah has already come, and that they did with him what they pleased, because they didn't recognize him, and they knew that he was talking about John the Baptist. So he's either Elijah will come, or Elijah has already come, or Elijah is John the Baptist. What are they supposed to make of that? It's too confusing. Now, as I was reflecting on this, I realized that there's a tendency nowadays, I've just tried to make a connection, I hope I can make this clear. Nowadays, there's an expectation that great literature and great movies will have complexity, that the characters will be nuanced and they don't fit into a box. If you go back to the, say, the 40s, the 50s, you know, black hat, white hat, good guy, bad guy, maybe there's some difficulties, you know, the man falls in love with the wrong woman or something like that. There's always some kind of tension, but it's clear who's who in a lot of drama. And if you go back to morality tales, go back earlier in history, there's complexity in the sense of challenges that the protagonists face, but there's not complexity about who's who. But when you get into postmodernism, the expectation is that nobody fits into a box and everybody is complex. And so a good story is a story that is complex. It's got subplots and themes and interlocking narratives and all these things. And people love that nowadays. I don't know if you love it, but that's the way, you know, if you want to get a Pulitzer Prize or a Nobel Prize in literature, or if you want to, you know, make a big splash in the world, don't have black hat, white hat. That just doesn't work anymore. You have to have people who do great things, but they have tragic flaws. They have good influence, but they also, you know, have addictions or they do terrible things in their private life, or all kinds of things like this. Just watch TV and you'll see it all. Well, and the reason why I'm going into this is because I noticed that in the world, that's considered good, that's considered developed, to have complexity and kind of incoherence and mystery. But when God does this, people complain. Why isn't God more straightforward? Why does he make things so complicated? Why doesn't he make it clear what he wants me to do and what he's doing? Why is it mysterious? People complain about that. Kind of inconsistent, aren't we? We want our movies to be very, you know, rich and complex and make us think and also be enjoyable. But we want God to be very simple and just, you know, 1, 2, 3, here's the plan. And Jesus doesn't do that. So in this gospel, Jesus deliberately doesn't say A, B, C, go here, do that, and that's the end of the story. He reveals the complexity of how God's plan unfolds in real human experience. It's good to see that that's how it is, because then we can more readily accept it. God doesn't fit into a box either, even less than fictional characters or a person. He doesn't fit into a box. He is who he is. He doesn't change. He's perfect. He's almighty. But he still surprises us, and we don't understand him and what he's doing all the time. And that's a good thing, because we limit God. We make him less than he is in our imagination or in our expectations, but he doesn't limit himself. He doesn't stop being good and doing good for us. So when we find ourselves saying, Lord, why don't you act with more power and solve my problems? Why don't you provide me with what I need? We should take a step back and say, well, that's not how he works. And actually, Advent Christmas is a great time to reflect on this. When God came into the world, he didn't come with power. The powerful one became weak. Right? The rich one became poor. That's Christmas, isn't it? That's what we're celebrating. The rich one became poor. The Almighty became insignificant baby. That's how he enters into our lives. So when we have difficulties or we're facing contradictions and we say, well, God should do it differently, we're wrong. Because God does it the best possible way. Elijah, who was so powerful, so obviously a powerful prophet, he was not a great success, you know. That's why he was chased off into the desert. At one point, he thought he was the last one and that no one was following him. When he gets taken up, he has a successor, Elisha, the successor. But it wasn't that clear that Elijah's life, to him at least, it wasn't that clear that it had such a great impact. So we don't measure what God is doing by our experience alone. faith tells us God is doing more, and that's good, that's fine. If we can accept that, then we can cooperate, we can participate. One Elijah, one fiery prophet, one person, let's say, one person who's on fire with love of God and on fire to respond to the will of God, has a much greater impact than 1,000 lukewarm Christians who sometimes do religious things. That's the fact. So when we look at the phenomenon, let me go back to Simbangabe, of thousands or millions of people showing up for Mass at 4 in the morning, as beautiful as that is, one of them with great love for God will have more impact. One of them who prays with a pure heart, who's really abandoning himself or herself to God, will have much more impact on the intentions that he's praying for, or on the country, on the world, than the other million. So that's why John the Baptist, even though he looks like a failure at the end, he has enormous impact because he's yielded to God. And this is the lesson I want to leave you with. Be like a John the Baptist, be like an Elijah, in this sense of being 100% given to the will of God. Be on fire for God, or let the fire of God burn in you. No matter what impact it might seem to have or not have, that's not what's important. Be an instrument of God, or you allow God to work in you and through you, and that's what will change things. Amen.